everybody. Welcome to episode 12 of Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, and today we're going to creep down into the basement of human behavioral analysis and shine a flashlight upon some of the psychological implications evident in the investigation and subsequent conviction of Adnan Syed in the murder of his ex-girlfriend, Haemin Lee. While the case has obviously been covered exhaustively, and equally as well, at least from a factual standpoint, there are two things I feel very strongly in regard to this case. One, Adnan Syed deserves a new trial, which he's now getting. Two, I think he's guilty, which is the verdict I think we'll hear again, but maybe not for the right reasons, which I'll cover more here in a bit. Now, if you've listened to my show previously, you know we're not going to argue the validity of cell tower experts, pings, and all of that related nonsense, even though these issues are the basis for Adnan receiving a new trial. In fact, there's one element of criminal cases playing out in court in recent years that bothers me to a degree even remotely close to that of DNA, and that's cell phone records. We still try to make both of these things binary, irrefutable evidence in court, when the reality is that they're nothing more than inaccurate, contaminated garbage when subjected to certain circumstances. So, in the absence of fact, what are we going to discuss? Parallels. Of course, this is a bullshit cocktail I've crafted while your back was turned, and now I'm going to watch your bitter face as I hand it to you and watch you drink. Until the aftertaste hits you, and you realize we might just be onto something. So follow along as I crack the cellar door and descend to darkness, my friends. On January 13th, 1999, Maryland teenager and Woodlawn High School senior Haemin Lee disappeared after leaving the school in her car, just like any other day, and was never seen alive again. Her body was later discovered in a shallow grave in nearby Leakin Park by a man looking for a place to urinate where he'd have some privacy from passing cars on the nearby road. And while many students at the school were questioned regarding their whereabouts on that day, lending themselves to a solid alibi or simply the fact that they were ignorant of the events that transpired, one person's life ultimately hinged upon 21 minutes through which he seems unable to recall his activities. That person was Hay's ex-boyfriend, 17-year-old fellow senior Adnan Syed. And the specific question he can't answer is this. Where were you during this time? This is the question that was not definitively answered by his trial, nor was it answered with any satisfaction in resulting media coverage. In fact, we know his attorney, Christina Gutierrez, actually disregarded notes in her own files about another student, Asia McLean, having supposedly seen Adnan in the library during the time frame that the murder took place. She called bullshit. And why? She saw the same thing I do. Parallels. Connections. And how everything in the universe reveals its truth in the sun that shines upon the far side of our shadow. The one Carl Jung told us about. The one you have to pretend doesn't exist when you meet your girlfriend's parents. When you go to a job interview, when you have to squash the momentary desire to destroy another person's being, no matter how fantastical the pretenses that created the thought. Nobody can know about these things, but you can hide in there, behind those walls, where the evil can manifest, in darkness, in silence, in this buzzing that will never end. This is the lie. The whisper behind the smiles, the handshakes, and the fancy clothes. This is the beast, the primal essence of our being. It's our shadow. And the way we reveal the truth of the shadow is through the aforementioned parallels and connections, which distinctly means finding two diametrically opposed entities, whether it's emotions, entire personalities, or even physical traits, and follow the path at which they run concurrently, or parallel, until the connector, or adapter, which is the dominant of the two, crosses the boundary of this synthesis like a car swerving across lanes, causing a collision between the adapter and the port that creates a circuit. This circuit is simply known to us as, quote, the end of something. It could be anything, as all things end this way. I mean, just relate the notion of turning to your significant other and saying, this relationship is going nowhere. What that means is that there is a lack of progress, placed in a circuitous context, which could be defined by the lack of achieving any number of life goals a couple might have. But when we say things like this to each other, and a relationship of any kind with another person feels like it's going in circles, it's because evolution is moving forward and you're not. Simply put, you're wasting its fucking time. So the way evolution deals with people who do this, which is all of us, of course, is to place a mirror on the roadway ahead of us, so that we can see the truth for what it is. Accordingly, we become horrified by the sight as it gets closer with time, veer the car away from what we see ourselves becoming down the road, and slam into the car traveling in the lane next to us, running the vehicle off the road and leaving us with a clear path ahead in a different lane with a different destiny. And we know this is true, that all endings are circuitous, not the culmination of a road as we often depict romantically, because space continues to expand, and by all accounts, it is infinite in nature and scope. So, think of the past, everything that's behind you on this road, as an infinite graveyard of circuits spinning around and around, but going nowhere because they're connected only to their own being. And for our purposes, that being, that existence to which these circuits now cling, could be defined most easily as memory. They're papers in a filing cabinet, simply reference material gathered from previous experience that is valuable only for the investigation of motive. And that's what you and I are going to do right now. We're going to arrange these circuits on a pole and loop each of them through a canvas so that the fabric hangs beneath them like a shower curtain on which we could paint a portrait. And that finished image is going to reveal a killer. His name is Adnan Syed. And the way we're going to go about this is by something I call access. No, I don't have an interview with Adnan, or even a teenager who can't remember what happened in his life last Tuesday. But I do have connections. Just not to inside sources, or even journalists for that matter. No, the connections that will allow us access to Adnan's mind will be the manner in which his actions are filtered through the port. So, basically what you and I are trying to do is connect an HDMI cable from the connection at the wall, Adnan, to the place that's going to generate a clear image on the screen in front of our mind's eye, which is the port. Now, the port always fits into one of these categories, and sometimes multiple categories, depending upon circumstance. The port is never dominant over the adapter. The port does not take the lead. The port's weaknesses are readily apparent to the adapter because they're specifically the adapter's strengths. So, what I mean by this last one is that any time you hear about somebody being preyed upon, either physically or emotionally, it's because that person's weaknesses are the other's strengths. And that's what we're trying to uncover here in our first foray into naming the ports in this case. We want to know the specific quality that adapters seek in them. Well, for all intents and purposes, that quality is this. Vulnerability. We prey on those who are vulnerable. We all do. With our good looks, with our intellect, money, and so on. We utilize our strengths to extract what we need from other people. Now, in a normal situation, what makes this reasonable is that the other party, in any given circumstance, is doing the same thing to you. It's a trade-off. There's no shame in that. But manipulation and deception are different beasts entirely. Here's why. Traffic accidents like the one we just discussed are not realized as intentional until viewed in retrospect when you can see you needed to close the circuit to start a new one. What makes this so difficult sometimes, however, is that our hearts, as opposed to evolution, live in the present instead of the future. This is simply because love makes us feel content about the present moment, while positive change makes us feel better about the future. And we achieve these goals through closing circuits and finding new roads to travel with opposing energy, dominant and subordinate, that best complements our own, until we change once again, close that circuit, and repeat. The final closing of the circuit, of course, is death, aka the end of being alive. And now we arrive at Adnan's truth. Heyman Lee wanted to close the circuit. The goal is not just to say to someone that you're breaking up simply so it can be said explicitly. The ultimate goal in these situations is this. Resignation on behalf of both parties that something is over specifically because it's not working and it's time to move on to trying something else that might. Permanently. That's the plug coming out of the wall. The disconnection from the electricity that caused the spark to begin with. And this convergence of adapter to port is so important, so consuming, that it's the basis for everything in our world. Think about this. When you stick a plug in a wall, something ultimately comes to life. The same thing happens when you put a penis in a vagina, or a spoonful of ice cream into your mouth to make your taste buds explode. So, the overarching theme of this, the point I'm trying to make, is that humanity funnels all of its desire through this channel of adapter to port. Now, take a moment to consider one thing that makes you tick more than anything else. For some people, it could be sex. For others, it could be teaching Sunday school. But whatever it is that gets your heart pumping, ask yourself what it then causes you to do. The answer is this: take action. More specifically, you take action to get what you want. Because sex is achievable. Teaching the Word of God is achievable. Getting a book published is achievable. And so are many other things in this world, even that which seems impossible and is proven otherwise by courageous souls willing to risk their own well-being. But the one thing we cannot achieve, and that which causes us irreconcilable pain, is the fulfillment of unrequited love. And so, when the aforementioned traffic accident is destined to happen to precipitate change, but one party is unable to accept that the world works this way, that unfortunate human is then left alone in an ocean of emptiness as he drowns in a deluge of desire. And it's here, inside this pain, that he's left to stand with adapter in his hands, ready to use it like a weapon in any way he can. But it no longer connects to the object of his affection, so he tries harder and fails again. Ultimately, what he comes to learn is that, while he can't control the fact that the circuit must end, what he can control is the manner in which it does. In rationalizing this notion, it is then reasonable to suggest that the person, if he has accepted finality, would mold the nature of it to happen on his terms. So the first question we have to ask ourselves about this is, what would be most satisfying to Adnan Syed's desire, given the fact that his relationship is over with Hay, no matter what action he takes? Well, the reality is that the closest he can get to satisfying this desire is to prevent her from feeling that happiness with anyone else. And one does not have to be a psychopath to have this desire and act upon it. One only needs to rationalize that there is no other way to move forward in the absence of this action, and then ascertain it's worth the risk. But people like this could be defined as sociopaths, well-versed in deception and routinely taking actions that reveal themselves as narcissistic to a great degree. Though, that wasn't Adnan Syed in 1999, right? He was a good student, an EMT who liked elderly people, and even dated other girls after Hay broke up with him. He had big brown eyes, and certainly didn't look like a killer. He was just a kid. And he also volunteered at the mosque, and participated on the track team. For all intents and purposes, he was popular, good-looking, and not generally the type to strangle someone to death. But these things are bullshit. They're remnants of 20th century suburban politics where white people competed for the crown of who was the most wholesome family without revealing the alcoholic father, depressed mother, goth teen sister, and juvenile delinquent son for what they really were. Humans with problems. Understand this. When Hay broke up with Adnan, and he refused to accept it, even if only in his heart and mind, he was left behind, standing there alone with the adapter still in his hand, one for which there is no other port in the universe, unless Hay becomes a dead body. And we'll get to that in part two. But you see, Adnan was left standing behind with this port in his hand. He was then more able to identify others who were lost, others walking in circles with the desire to plug in these worthless adapters of the past to alleviate the pain. These are the zombies of our humanity, the slow-moving but relentless and flesh-eating creatures of humanity's rearview mirror that close in upon us if we stop moving forward. People like Jay. And when we start to refuse to participate in evolution's plan, which is perpetual change, we become bitter as we simply watch the parade pass by without us. But in the same way we can only stop a bus that's left the station by running after it, we can't stop evolution by standing in one place, pouting and stomping our feet. So with the refusal to join evolution comes the desire to destroy it. And this is evidenced every day by the shocking numbers of attractive young women who are brutally murdered at the hands of men. And it happens for one reason: the absence of love. When you love that which will not love you back, ultimately you'll believe that you're not worthy of being loved. And if you believe you're not worthy of being loved, by default, you are also no longer capable of giving it. This is isolation. This is where you realize that not only can you not find a port for your adapter, but that your adapter has finally revealed itself as worthless, even in your denials. And at that point, it's nothing but a limp stretch of cord lying in your hands as the anger boils to the surface inside you. The cord is no longer a connection to anything. It's simply a symbolic representation of the island where you now reside. Yet the desire still flows from one end of the cord to the other, trapped inside. And when you have something in your hands that, for this reason, this lack of release, causes you overwhelming desire, disappointment, and hopelessness, what do? You take those hands, using your desire, and strangle someone. You kill evolution. And here's why. Because evolution doesn't just leave you behind when you display antisocial behavior and continue to try to find a way to connect your cord and find its value again. No, instead what it does is it first isolates you from everyone else psychologically and in terms of emotional distance, which then manifests physically when escape or release is never achieved. The feeling this causes is specifically this: suffocation. You can't breathe in a place where perpetual failure is imminent. It's like smoke filling a room. In fact, it's the definition of insanity. So think about this for a moment. Antisocial behaviors where we're no longer able to make connections from adapter to port, but continue to try, leave us feeling isolated, like we're suffocating to death. So if you were having this feeling, that you were suffocating due to the port no longer allowing you the connection of placing your adapter into it, you could easily draw the conclusion the port in question does not agree with your plight. And what do we say when others don't seem to understand the suffering associated with our circumstances? We say they can't sympathize with us. And what do we feel because of this? We feel anger. And with this anger, what then becomes our primary desire? To make the person, or the port, understand what we feel. And what is the only way to make that person understand what it's like to feel alone, suffocating, and dying at the hands of someone she loved dearly, while still surrounded by other people who were laughing, loving, and going about life? To kill her. Maybe even strangle her to death in the parking lot of Best Buy. You see, Haman Lee suffocated to death, in the absence of love, surrounded by people, and most importantly, alone. This is the reflection of Adnan Syed's rage. It's a mirror. This is our first parallel. This is you. This is me. It is within all of us. It is the night. It is the shadow. It's the truth lurking over your shoulder in darkness. It is every kernel of irreconcilable pain you've ever felt chained to your ankle and following you through the life to remind you that it will never end until you do. And that's a burden we all bear, one that we lie through with smiles and an incredibly sad, desperate plight to maintain a sense of perception over truth. This was Adnan Syed's life, that of a cumulative, all-encompassing lie. His existence was the training grounds for a murderous sociopath, one who's been nearly publicly exonerated of a crime for which he'd been preparing for years, even in the absence of specificity regarding the future victim. Essentially, what I'm saying is that we are a product of our environment, so to speak, and the primary values of Adnan's existence in his high school days was predicated upon two things: deception and perception. In between, what we find is oppression. Now think of it this way. Deception is the adapter. Perception is the port. The cord where the power runs between these two, that not only acts as a conduit for desire, but an impetus, is oppression. And the wrath of oppression is what led to this crime. How do we know this? Well, let's reverse engineer some of the previous statements here. Oppression implies lack of freedom, and a lack of freedom, from a symbolic standpoint, could easily be likened to the feeling of suffocation. Therefore, one could fairly surmise that if a lack of freedom feels like suffocation, then we can also state that the continual feeling of suffocation over time would be akin to feeling like you were going to die because you couldn't breathe. And here we get our second parallel. the manner in which Adnan's family's traditional Muslim faith conflicted with his life of being an American teenager caused him to feel oppressed by it. And when it suffocated his relationship to the point that Hay began to break things off, there was no choice, by default, for Adnan to act in a manner other than that which would satisfy the rage of oppression and the resulting fallout of losing Hayman Lee because of it. But still, I know, you're asking yourself, but would he really kill her? I mean, I've had my heart broken before and had trouble moving on. It happens to everybody. Sure, it does happen to everybody. But here's what makes Adnan's case different, and here's why he made the decision to kill. The first thing I do when I read or watch about a suspected killer, in trying to determine innocence or guilt, is not evaluate evidence, but analyze the nature of the crime in relation to the perceived intellect of the accused. This is often the most revealing manner of analysis, most effectively utilized when the person conducting an investigation possesses intellectual qualities that are superior to that of the suspected criminal. In this light, the easiest people to spot are not idiots and those who kill without care for physical evidence. In these situations, it's often difficult to distinguish ineptitude from apathy and intent from ignorance. Where we find the most interesting and mysterious cases, however, generally falls in the arena of the accused having moderate to above average intelligence, but no greater or less than that ideal. The reason for this, for why we have so many baffling cases featuring minds like Patsy Ramsey, Damien Eccles, and a million other superstars of American tragedy who fall into this category, is that they are intelligent enough, possess the ability to address the nuances of deception, but the fact that their intellect is not elevated past this point leaves them incredibly vulnerable to the one thing that routinely brings even the best criminals to their knees: lack of self-awareness. Those blessed with elevated intellects, even if narcissistic, are amazingly self-aware by default of their understanding of how the macro integrates with the micro, of how their existence fits into the universe, and of the absence of absolute truth. The difference between the former type of mind and the latter, again, is that the moderately intelligent mind intends to persuade through deception, while the brilliant mind intends to reveal by way of truth. The difference is the first person is a salesman, while the second is a prophet, and the prophet sees the salesman for what he is, a con artist, because truth doesn't need to be sold. Only lies need to be sold. But there's only one way a person can bring himself to see lies as truth. We call that endeavor, quite simply, denial. Denial is the vendor of all lies, distributed solely from a warehouse full of boxes and worthless circuits that no longer work or connect from adapter to port and produce love, but are still for sale nonetheless. This is the province of the average sociopath, of he who is blessed with the ability to articulate his lies for consumption, but without regard for others. And a point at which we begin to disregard the sovereignty of others, whether in love or war, is when we feel as though we're being oppressed by something. This is the sole basis for the existence of politics in our world, for keeping secrets by way of telling lies. And it's also the reason Adnan Syed can't bring himself to admit that he committed this crime. And I'm about to tell you why. Please listen to the following statements, and take account of your emotional reaction to them, even if they aren't specific, or even relevant, to your current situation in life. Here they are. I fucked your sister. I kicked your grandmother in the stomach as hard as I could. I stole $500 from your wallet. I tied your dog's tail to a pole and walked away laughing. I poured black paint over the windshield of your car. I went to your church and spray-painted a big dick on Jesus. Okay, so I think we can agree that any of these statements, if true, would incite emotion, if not also subsequent action, from the party who is affected by them. And the reason is because we generally don't say things like this unless they're true, or we're obviously joking, because they're entirely unacceptable actions. But what we can say for sure is that, in the context of each of these being true, they all hit like a punch to the face when spoken. And what happens when someone incites us with the truth of their actions? There are consequences. So what do we do to avoid consequences? We tell lies. But since these lies are, by default, baseless, they must be wrought of a circuitous nature. Simply put, they can't go anywhere. They have to turn in circles again and again, to no avail. And as we just saw, the truth doesn't do that. Ever. It always travels in a straight line. Now, considering this, go back to an extremely popular series that featured Adnan, listen to him speak throughout those episodes, and the one thing that is abundantly clear is that he can't give a definitive answer for anything. He just keeps talking and talking, trying to bring his words to a specific destination that is an impossibility coming from the place of guilt from which he embarked. He's articulate and charming, and spends all of his time trying to use the smiley, upbeat inflections of being a decent person to establish his character with us. Except the problem here is that his position on the matter, in general, is an abomination of human nature, one he wants to offset with a simple excuse. I can't remember where I was after school on the day of Hayes' murder. It was just a normal day. It was like any other day. And here I'm going to just pause a moment so as to not elaborate upon how truly disgusting I think this guy is. Okay, and here we get back to self-awareness, to why Adnan is not intelligent enough to have this one go over our heads without calling it out for what it is. Bullshit. This is a fucking bold-faced lie. Plain and simple. Now, I'm not a neurologist, psychologist, psychiatrist, neurosurgeon, or anything of that ilk. I'm just some idiot who likes to analyze human nature as it pertains to crime. I never aim to be right. I just aim to enlighten in whatever way I can because my opinion is unique to the world, in the same way yours is valuable. But here's where Adnan Syed makes me want to scream. The place where his lack of self-awareness bites him in the ass really hard and he doesn't even turn to look. This is the stuff of a sociopath, of a person who has come to believe his lie because he doesn't possess the intellectual capability to squash denial by revelation of truth. And what does this also make him, by default? A coward. Now, here's what I want you to do. Travel back in your mind to that place we discussed a few minutes ago where you conjured your greatest desire. Think about that desire for a moment. Let it begin to eat at you, at your willpower. And then think about the times where it actually overwhelmed you, where you felt like you might be losing control and were afraid there would be consequences, whether it was sex involving dangerous bondage or you just ate too much chocolate pudding and felt sick. Think about how you succumbed to desire, and how once it's over you feel ashamed for having wilted in the face of the feelings, even if you enjoyed yourself. Think about the unstoppable thirst that led you to it, how it pulled you in, like a vampire bringing sharp fangs through the soft flesh of the neck, lusting for blood, for connection. This is the shadow. This is the night. This is the rage hiding beneath the surface. And just as you experience this incredible thirst for comfort, your brain is equally dedicated to performing that plight in the name of comprehension and lack of confusion, which is most easily and readily defined as this: the pursuit of context. Your brain is constantly receiving new information, to an extent you couldn't even begin to fathom the database it's compiled through experience, from a quantitative standpoint. But no matter the extent of its experience, it's going to get rattled by certain elements coming into play in your actions. Now, the most immediate and relevant element of brain function, as it pertains to simply maintaining your existence by way of survival, is to establish context. And we know this is incredibly important because it's even the foundation of journalistic reporting. We want to know who, what, where, why, how, and when. The removal of any one of those elements could seriously change the story. So, this is exactly where I call bullshit on Adnan. I'll tell you why. I remember 2 days from the year 2001. If you put a gun to my head, I still wouldn't be able to conjure any further memories. But let's look at the days I remember. 1. The first time I went skydiving. 2. The day my mother died. Now, I think it's easy to see the impetus for remembering these events, as the scale of importance, in terms of either danger or loss, was of a great magnitude. Yet, Adnan Syed, who learned of the disappearance of the love of his life no more than several hours after it happened, in a situation where she was subsequently found brutally murdered and dumped in a shallow grave, can't seem to remember where he was that afternoon because it was just a normal day. So, being that Adnan can't remember, I feel inclined to remind him of this. The reason he can't remember is because he was in Hayes' car strangling her to death. He had motive, he had opportunity, and we have no other viable suspect. But there's a lack of physical evidence, you say. Fair enough. We're going to take a good hard look at that. And now we get to the psychology of why he thought he could get away with it. He'd been trained. But how? And by whom? Well, by oppression, which was the desire running through this cord between the adapter of religion and the port of his parents' wishes. So, with this, we now arrive at our third parallel. Adnan's relationship with his parents and how it mimicked the crime perfectly. In the entire human history of the Earth, we have spilled the blood of others for a singular reason, and that motivation alone. And that's this, philosophical differences. And if we were to outline the elements that comprise this truth, we would find religion is the main subtitle of the broad categorization of these things. And while I have absolutely no problem with any religious faith and wish nothing but freedom for everyone to worship openly and without fear of judgment or reprisal for what's important to them, I also understand that religion was born of the necessity to control and discipline large populations of people in archaic societies where physical resources could not solely accommodate the endeavor of spreading fear as a means of moderating behavior. Religion was history's version of Big Brother, the notion that you were being watched at all times and could face consequences for your unseen evil deeds, which was great 2,000 years ago, when it was still reasonable to believe gods were physical entities capable of retribution. Yet modern comforts, particularly science, have debunked many long-held beliefs regarding faith that make it difficult for those still practicing to proceed in a manner that doesn't heavily involve one element: control. And what happens when the science of your reason for controlling a group of people is debunked? You have to turn up the volume on control to tighten your grip. And what do you get when you tighten the grip on control? Oppression. And what does oppression lead to? Very simply, it leads to a choice: rebel or succumb. This is the reason religion tries to control thought, because it cannot control emotion. Emotion is exclusive to rebellion. It is the cord of desire running between the adapter of oppression and the port of freedom. But there's this. Most of us don't have the means to escape oppression physically, and are forced to continue to live within the confines of it in the absence of alternatives. And this is where Adnan Syed found himself in 1999, living under the roof of an oppressive existence that had little to no sympathy for anything other than tradition. He was volunteering to help out at the mosque while smoking weed, drinking, and fucking his classmates on the side. Basically, he wanted to be a regular American teen, for better or worse, and was shackled by heritage. And this is when Adnan not only learned how to deceive his elders, particularly authority figures in the form of his parents, by peppering them with constant lies, but also became proficient in the removal of physical evidence in places where he'd be subjected to the scrutiny of investigation on a regular basis. For instance, we know Adnan admitted he would routinely check his car to be sure a girl hadn't left her hair in it, or any items that could identify someone as female. And if he was smoking weed, he was hiding it somewhere. And if he was going somewhere he shouldn't have been to do things like this, he named those places as something other than what they really were. And one could argue that this is the normal life of a teenager. But I argue the distinction is that the average teen, so to speak, utilizes these devices of deception on occasions where he or she knows a boundary of good taste might be crossed in the eyes of the parents. But for Adnan, who was raised with such a restrictive traditional upbringing, this was the norm. Not doing it would have been the exception. This was the life he lived. A lie, in service of nothing more than oppression. And this undoubtedly made him angry. It made him defensive and unscrupulous, and so many other negative qualities. Because the truth is this: if you're not fostering freedom, you're suffocating. Adnan's existence had been strangling him since day one, and he responded in kind. Of course, the reason he did this is because it's the only thing he'd ever been taught, which is to suffocate those you love with unrealistic ideals to the point they can no longer breathe, to the point they drown in their misery, alone. And here's where they proved it: when his parents showed up to the school dance to confront him for being with Hay. They embarrassed him, shamed him, tore the two young lovers apart. And while we can't pinpoint the exact moment of the breakup, this was clearly the impetus, a major driving force in Hay coming to realize that there were other fish in the sea. And just like that, she was gone from his life, never to return. So, A heartbroken young man desperate to find peace turned to oppression, as it was all he knew to gain control again. Subsequently, he engaged the disunity between strong desire and poor logic, as he'd always been taught to act, and killed Haman Lee to salvage his bride. Basically, if he couldn't have her, nobody could. But how could he possibly think he'd get away with it, you'd ask? Easy. He's been conditioned all his life to believe that faith transcends logic. So if he believes he can get away with murder, in his mind that possibility is already reality. Because, as I discussed in a previous episode covering the disappearance of Brandon Lawson, humanity started looking to the sky for answers instead of its heart because it had not evolved to a point of having a rudimentary grasp of how the universe actually worked. And because this began so long ago in our history, its tradition persists even today and will continue to do so in spite of logic. And the reason for this is that humanity is afraid to say, "I don't know." In the absence of definitive answers, however, we often choose to engage the disunity between strong desire and poor logic. But while it's empowering to admit you don't know and take action to alleviate your ignorance, it's far more popular to proclaim omnipotence and shield yourself from fear of the unknown with a pre-filled template. And there isn't anything wrong with this per se. We should all be able to choose how we'd like to live. I'm merely discussing this now, in the context of the crime, because there's an inherent flaw within migrating to a culture which generally conflicts with your moral values, and then attempting to raise your children under its rules while simultaneously expecting them to adhere to a system of behavior that's antithetical to avoiding conflict. Simply put, it's a square peg in a round hole. And this isn't specific to any one culture or religion. This is the plight of the immigrant in America, and always has been, to try to reconcile that which they have left behind with that they face on the road ahead. It's a challenge, and much like parenting, there just simply isn't any guide that could prepare you for it. So we all do the best we can, as I'm sure Adnan's parents did, but it's fair to say his dishonesty stems directly from his inability to reconcile the difference between his own desires and that of his parents. That was his downfall. And after thinking about all this, and all of the time that's passed since that cold, dreary day in January 1999, I looked back to some photos of the young couple, mostly of them separately, but one or two together. And the sadness of the event hit me all at once. The truth. Both of their lives ended that day, each as senselessly as the other. The magnitude of the loss beyond any words I could offer right now. But what I can say is this. Haman Lee truly seemed like an amazing person, beautiful both inside and out, despite any flaws to which we might not have been privileged to know. I tried to take myself back in time, to put myself in Adnan's shoes, to conjure any rationalization of pain that I could muster in order to understand how badly his heart was broken. But no matter how long I looked at her face smiling back from beyond the grave and wondered what kind of loss he experienced when she dumped him, I simply could not forget that he took her life. But that was when I looked at Adnan's picture again. And it gave me the chills. The truth hit me all at once. Not because I saw guilt. No. What I saw was the sun shining on the back end of the shadow, illuminating the darkness within. The monster. And I understood why he was driven to do this. That beautiful person with a bright future, the one who deserved to be loved, the one I saw in Hay's eyes, that's also what I saw when I looked at Adnan. He was a great person. He had a lot to offer. She just didn't want it anymore and chose to move on. So he snapped. Okay, now, in part two, we're going to examine how the crime transpired, disposal of the body, a very convoluted but interesting character named Jay, and the lies of Asia McClain. So join me next week as I dive into these topics and much more. It's going to be weird, wacky, and insightful, in a way that's going to make you want to punch me in the face. Repeatedly. And with tremendous force. I promise. But before I go, I want to share something I once witnessed a few years ago. An occurrence I believe is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And also the specific memory that inspired me to give thought to this case. I want to point out a juncture in the lives of many young men and why this event resonated with me. I was sitting in a very popular coffee franchise on Colfax Avenue in Denver in 2014, right around the time this case blew up, in terms of popularity, and I noticed a young couple at a table nearby. They were clearly high school students, but looked like they were of an age where they were seniors on their way out. The boy was this quirky but handsome kind of hipster dude who had spiked hair, wore glasses, and undoubtedly played the guitar or did something engaging that made him a great high school boyfriend, if not a trophy husband. Meanwhile, the girl was very pretty. It would seemingly be maturing to a place where she was going to be out of this kid's league entering adulthood. And it was clear to me that they were breaking up, leaning across the table at each other, holding hands like they didn't want to let go. And I could see they were equally crushed by this. But the boy was clearly the one getting dumped, as I could hear him continue to beg her to, quote, not do this. But, as the ladies listening right now know, by the time she brought it to his attention, she had long since made her decision. It was final. Yet, they wouldn't part. Though, soon the words dwindled, and the coffee went cold, until there was only silence. Both hands embracing became one with an excuse to reach for a phone. And soon enough, when the boy finally understood it was over, when the girl would no longer do anything but sit in silence and avoid looking at his face, he stood up and walked out the door. And I watched the girl for a moment, how she remained there with her hand still on the table, alone. And she stared straight ahead at what her future now looked like without him as a part of it. There was freedom in her pain. It was sad. It was beautiful. And it was necessary. But most of all, it was bittersweet. Because the end is always the beginning. So as I watched the girl walk out the door and disappear around the corner of the building, I turned to see the boy standing outside by his bike watching in the direction she went. I could almost see him twitch. I could see his desire to not relent, to fight for what he believed. He was going to run after her, I thought. He was going to win her back. I was sure of it. I wanted to cheer for this dude, to stand up and pump my fist in victory. And it was then the truth hit me. It was over. He wasn't going to get her back. I was in denial. I was crushed. I wanted the world to work like that. I still do. So, all at once, I understood the overwhelming rejection and disbelief Adnan felt. But most of all, I felt the enormous burden of finality haunting my tortured soul. That was when I looked back to the boy at the coffee shop, to his hesitation, to his desire, to his fate in this world. And I screamed from the silence of my heart, "Don't do it. Let her go." And he did. The kid turned away a moment, looked around him, and seemed to be considering something. When he rotated back to me, I could see tears rolling down his face. And I couldn't look away. So I didn't. But strangely, neither did he. And what I saw in his eyes is simply this, that he was going to be okay. Not today, or tomorrow, or even next month, but he's going to heal and even find love. That's when he got on his bike, pedaled off, and learned how to start living again. And the lesson in this, and what that kid truly saw when he viewed the girl fading into the distance, was not loneliness, but his own personal prison. And every step he took toward her was another step closer to being locked inside it. Forever. This is where Adnan Syed resides. And no matter what happens in his new trial, he always will.